Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Over the past few weeks, we've heard about the struggle one single mom is facing as she juggles school, work, and parenting. On this week's episode, we'll hear the conclusion to Crystal Snyder's struggle to stay story. And in McDowell County, schools can't find enough teachers, so a new approach is encouraging local high school students to think about returning home to teach after they go away to college.
I plan on being a biology teacher, coming back to McDowell. And I just want to make it different than what it is. When I come back, I want to fix it. And I'm not going to just ditch my students.
Remember the cliques that divided up kids at your high school? Years later, one man recalls the stigma of being from the poor side of town.
We got made fun of because we bought clothes at Kmart. Comments about our blue light specials. We never really had a problem with clothes until we came to school up on the hill.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Well, it's September, and for many people, including myself, this means the beginning of a new school year. In addition to working with West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I also teach at Concord University, a small liberal arts school in southern West Virginia, which also happens to be the place I went to college. But anyway, I'm telling you this because the theme of today's episode is all about school and why some Appalachians are going back to school to pursue new opportunities. The start of a new school year can be a stressful time, but it's also a season of transition and of new beginnings. Later in our show, we'll travel to rural McDowell County, where schools can't find enough teachers to fill their classrooms. But first, we're going to check back in with a woman who you might recognize. Her name is Crystal Snyder, and her story is part of our ongoing series, The Struggle to Stay. The outmigration of people leaving Appalachia is nothing new. Folks have been heading for the cities elsewhere for generations to find work and new opportunities. Still, there are a few here who are determined to stay. And for many, staying also means struggling. So we decided to follow six people for about a year to see how they are managing to stay and if they can find a way to support their family here in Appalachia. Lately, we've been following Crystal's journey as she started a job training program called Refresh Appalachia. She's learning how to grow squash and shiitake mushrooms. She's also going to a community college, working on her associate's degree in applied science. Crystal is a single mom, and it hasn't been easy to balance school, work, and family responsibilities. Last time we heard from her, she'd been put on work probation after an unexcused absence. On top of this, she just found out that her 18-year-old son, Aaron, had dropped out of high school.
The hardest thing is balancing it all. I don't want to be negative, but I don't know if it's possible. No, I forget that. It's possible.
A quick warning to parents. There are some parts of Crystal's next story that might not be suitable for kids. Roxy Todd picks back up with Crystal's story as she was preparing for a meeting with her supervisors.
Last August, Crystal was devastated when she was put on work probation. Up till that point, work at Refresh Appalachia had been going great, and her boss, Ben Gilmer, says she's consistently been one of the hardest workers at their company.
When she's on the job site, it's clear that everyone else kind of steps up their game to keep up with her. She sets the pace, which I admire a lot.
So it seemed out of character for her when she didn't show up to work one day. Ben knew Crystal was volunteering for Bernie Sanders in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention, but he didn't know she was staying an extra 2 days. Crystal did send an email, but it didn't arrive until the day she was scheduled to work. Anyway, they asked her to come to a special meeting to talk about why she didn't give them a heads up sooner. And, as it turned out, it was also a meeting for them to find out if she was okay, because Ben could tell she was having a rough time.
At the time, I think I was trying to help her with, I think, some like personal finance management, some other stuff. And I think that was the nature of the conversation, was like, there's also a big role to play here, you know, within your, first of all, yourself, your family unit, your community here, your job. We all depend on each other.
Crystal said the talk with Ben was helpful, even though it didn't fix everything. They took her off work probation and helped her to plan a personal budget. She decided to cut some unnecessary purchases.
So I finally started bringing my coffee to work because I was spending like $4 every single day on coffee in the morning.
She realized she spent $500 a month at restaurants and at coffee shops. So she started cooking more, which helped. And there was another positive change for Crystal. After all the squash had been replanted, she asked to be transferred from Cabell County to Lincoln County High School's greenhouse. Even though it means a longer drive, the different location helped Crystal. She likes working with the high school students and teaching them to grow food. And she gets to work with two people she's grown to be close friends with, Colt and Caroline. They joke that they're the three C's. They also started to grow shiitake mushrooms at the Lincoln County site. This type of farming is what Crystal is most passionate about. She smiles when she drills holes in logs and hammers in little plugs with shiitake spawn. In about 8 months, these logs will grow shiitake mushrooms.
Being out here and being in Lincoln County is like, it's just got me like wanting to just go off the grid. Just grow my own food and and stay out here. It's just so beautiful.
Then, in January 2017, the Refresh Appalachia crew went on a retreat. All of Crystal's co-workers in Mingo, Lincoln, and Cabell counties got together for a two-day meeting. On the first day, everyone stood in front of their colleagues to talk about their life story. Crystal was the first one to talk. Later, she shared the stories again while the two of us were sitting in her living room. And a warning, this may not be suitable for young listeners to hear. She said she told her coworkers about some really scary stuff that happened to her as a child, like the time when her family was robbed when she was 8 years old.
My dad was heavier into, like, he was selling cocaine at that point, and we lived in the East End, 7th Avenue and 14th Street in Huntington, and he had some shady friends, and they knew he had a stash, and they kicked in the door, and there were guns, and it was so scary. I thought they were going to kill him, and I thought they were going to kill us. And my mom was just screaming, and we were all just screaming.
She also told her coworkers about an earlier trauma when she was sexually molested by a friend of her father's.
When I was 5, we went to Florida to pick up some weed. I remember huge black garbage bags in the back of the trunk when we went down there, but on the way down there, his friend, I said he touched my monkey is what I told my mom when we got back, but he just touched my private parts. And I told my mom and dad, and they said my dad beat the guy up, but to me that just was not enough. You know, like, they didn't call the police because they were there for something that was illegal, so they couldn't really report it. But we didn't talk about it. Like, I didn't even know it was real until I was, like, 18. I was talking to my sister, and she's like, yeah, that happened. And I was like, why didn't we talk about this?
Sharing these stories with her coworkers marked a turning point for Crystal. She hadn't shared these stories with many other people, especially not with a group of about 12 other people listening. Her boss, Ben, said the story seemed to inspire the rest of her coworkers.
When Crystal, she leads from her heart like that, and it allows other people to, I think, access that within themselves in a different way. And I saw that. So we, each of us, including myself, probably, you know, we just opened up in a way we wouldn't have otherwise because she started off that way.
After the work retreat, Crystal started to focus more on how much she's overcome in life. The experience also encouraged her to start seeing a therapist.
Just learning to stop the bad thoughts and not worry. Like, just worry does so much harm and no good. So it kind of forced me to snap out of it and refocus on all the wonderful things in my life.
She's not worrying as much about politics or climate change, or what direction the country is heading. Instead, she's trying to spend more of her energy on making change here in West Virginia and with her own family.
My therapist helped me, like, realize, like, you just do what you can. And Ben, too, just do what you can locally. But when she would say that, I was just like, yeah, like, right. Like, why does that matter, what I do locally, if globally we have no control
But really, it does, or at least it makes me feel better.
She's so strong and resilient. For that reason, she's had to provide for herself, I think, largely her whole life and protect others.
One thing her boss, Ben, says he's continually blown away by is her ability to lead workshops in farming and teach other farmers how to grow shiitake mushrooms. Ben says Crystal is a born educator.
I wouldn't be surprised if she ends up being a teacher, you know, one day. But I'm not going to, like, project that on her. She could go in lots of directions, but she'll always be a teacher, I guess, no matter what she does. But one step at a time, though, I know she's focused on getting through school and, you know, doing well at Refresh.
What are you most proud of?
My resiliency, my tenacity. I'm proud that I shine my light still, maybe more so than maybe I would have if I hadn't experienced darkness. I'm proud of my kids, their kindness, and I'm proud to be in the field of agriculture. I'm proud to be on this journey, and I don't know where it's going, but it's going somewhere good.
A year and a half after I began helping Crystal record her story, she's now in her fourth semester at Mount West Community College, and she's loving school. Last semester, she got her first B, and she's proud of that B. She's aiming for an A this semester. She also got a job promotion and a raise and was made a crew leader at Refresh Appalachia. Her son Aaron is working on getting his graduate equivalency degree, or GED. Like his mom, he says he wants to be a farmer. Crystal dreams of one day owning land where she, Aaron, and her daughter Morgan can have a farm together. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
On our website, you can hear all of our Struggle to Stay stories. That's at wvpublic.org. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll meet the next person we'll be following in this series, a laid-off miner from Pennsylvania named Dave Hathaway.
I won't move. I love Greene County. And I got ties here, so, you know, my kid and everything. I'm just not leaving. I mean, I'll travel, but, yeah, I'm not leaving.
We'll hear that story next week right here on Inside Appalachia. But for now, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, students at high schools often divide up into camps between rich kids and poor kids. But looks can be deceiving. We'll travel with producer Trey Kay to revisit some of his high school classmates. That's coming up next after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
So there's this phrase, and you've probably heard it a time or two, kids can be so mean. The phrase is usually used during conversations about the tough times in middle school and high school. You probably remember cliques that kids in your school divided themselves into. Maybe jocks, punks, hippies, rednecks, theater geeks, stoners. Now, don't get me wrong. I was all of them. Just kidding. But I would say I wore most of those labels in high school. Some of these labels inevitably came after joining a club, taking a class, or simply participating. But in one Charleston, West Virginia high school, there was another us-and-them sorting classification. You were either a hiller or a creaker. On a recent episode of the Us and Them podcast, we hear why clothes and shoes had so much importance. Host Trey Kay takes us back to his high school to re-explore an ongoing divide between two groups, the Hillers and the Creekers.
In West Virginia, everything is a mountain, and the people with money, you know, the lawyers and the doctors lived up at the top of the hill, and the plumbers and the electricians lived at the bottom of the hill.
If you wear camo, you're considered a Creeker.
Levi's.
A hat and boots.
Big belt.
And blue jeans.
Flannels all the time.
Hillers dressed in
Vineyard Vines brand, Patagonia brand.
Docksiders and collared shirts.
The boys wear really short shorts and pink a lot. The Hillers are in the advanced class.
Kind of think that they're better than you.
Very well educated.
Almost all go to college.
Creekers went to technical school.
Creekers work all the way through school.
The Creekers do the hard drugs.
The Hillers, they got so much money.
They get addicted to the drugs.
Drive a brand new Mercedes car and they're 16 years old.
Creekers actually had nicer cars. They had hot rods because they worked on them.
They don't work after school.
Those are Hillers. They're the preppy kids. The Creekers are
uneducated.
The country people, like,
dirt poor.
Well, their accents were a little thicker.
You're a redneck. We call them Creekers still.
They don't really call them Hillers anymore. They're kind of
preps. They are very preppy.
And very rich.
But we're still Creekers.
Those were voices from past and present students from George Washington High School who let me know that this Hiller-Creeker division is still alive and kicking. George Washington is located in the affluent South Hill suburb of Charleston, but it also serves neighboring towns of mixed socioeconomic levels, such as Loudondale, Davis Creek, and Allen Creek. When I was a kid, I lived in South Hills and was thus a Hiller. It wasn't like the Jets and Sharks fighting over turf. Some of my Facebook friends reminded me that there was a rumble once, but I don't remember anything about it. Those who claim to recall it have some really hazy details about why it happened. What I remember was there was a good bit of sticking with your pack. I mean, I don't remember sitting at the same lunch table with Creekers. But I did have some Creeker friends. We played football together. My friend Randy Thomas was then and still is a proud Creeker. He recently drove me around his hometown of Loudondale in his new pickup truck. He wanted to take me to some of the places where he used to play as a kid, and the only way to get there was to literally drive right through Davis Creek. So, Randy, what the hell are we doing?
Well, I'm going to try to take you over here to where the Little League baseball field used to be.
But we're driving across a creek right now. We're driving across the creek.
Yeah, so?
That's okay.
I got to figure out how I'm going to turn around here.
All right, I'm in a big Ford pickup truck.
No, you are not. Ford. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to throw you out right here in the middle of this creek.
I'm in a Chevy pickup truck.
Yes. Gee-my-knee. That's blasphemy. I'll never be your friend again.
I know you're lying. but we crossed a creek, and he didn't want to make a three-point turn, so he backed up. And I thought, oh, man, I don't know if I'd do that. But then again, I'm in the cab of a truck. A professional driver.
A professional truck driver.
Now, Randy and I have known each other since we both arrived at John Adams Junior High School from different elementary schools. Randy felt the education he'd received up until then left him at a disadvantage.
One thing that stood out to me was this thing called a term paper. Man, that smacked me right between the eyes. I went to Loudondale Elementary, and when I got to John Adams, and they wanted you to do a term paper, I had no idea of what a term paper was, and it sure seemed like all of my friends that were from the schools up on the hill knew exactly what a term paper was. It seemed like they knew what a source was and, oh goodness.
Bibliography.
Yeah, all those things that you needed to do a term paper, it seemed like they knew exactly what it was, where to get them, all those things. I had no clue. And I just felt lost. I felt lost.
Randy also noticed how Hillers dressed differently than Creekers, right down to the shoes.
My shoes came from Pickway.
To people who don't know, what's Pickway?
Pickway would be the equivalent of like Shoe Carnival now.
So like an inexpensive place to buy cheap shoes.
Very inexpensive. My tennis shoes growing up cost about $2 a pair. By the time I got to John Adams, I was wearing Converse. But I had to fight my parents to get them. I mean, they were just like, oh my God. And back then they were what, maybe $20 if that. And they just didn't see the value in it.
So just walk me through that a little bit. So basically, you know, you went to school and were you kind of a little bit embarrassed of your Pickway shoes? And that, like, you know, mom, dad kind of just at least have something that you know, I'm not going to be laughed at or whatever. All these other kids have Adidas and Nikes. And you really had to kind of lean on your parents to let you get some shoes that, is that? I feel like I've touched a nerve.
They didn't understand. I don't think they understood the difference. I ended up taking my own money and I went and bought the Nike Cortez, I think is what they called it.
Yeah. The red stripe.
With the red swoop on it. Yeah. It's not a stripe, it's a swoop. I mean, you know, Nike will let you know that. I think that shoe cost $35. I remember. I'd been working at the ballpark and I'd crossed the hill over into South Park, caught the bus, went to Sport Mart on Courier Street in downtown Charleston, bought the Nikes, put them on before I ever left the store, and I styled and profiled and left there. Yes, sir.
Oh, man, the shoes. Who would have thought that shoes could be so important? But they mattered to me, too. By the time I got to John Adams, I was worried about brand name clothes and shoes because of one kid. Joey Minardi moved into my neighborhood the year before I went to Adams, and he was obsessed with brand name clothes. He knew about Pumas, Nikes, and Adidas, and he talked about them so much that he got me and my brother amped up about them, so much so that we begged our mother to buy us pairs. One day when we were in the sixth grade class, I had a question for the teacher, and I walked up to the front of the classroom. And as I did, Joey calls from the back of the room, "Will the guy with the sorry Adidas please sit down?" And I snapped. I started screaming. "Why is this such a big deal for you? Why do you have to keep going on about my shoes? Why do you have to be the one with the best shoes in the class?" And he got up out of his seat, and we met each other in the middle of the classroom, and we just locked and started swinging big roundhouse haymaker punches. And at one point he tackled me and he got on top of me and he grabbed my ears like they were handles on a jug and he just started smashing my skull into the floor. I mean, all of this over a pair of freaking Adidas. I told Randy this story. And I also told him about how I remembered being with Joey when he used to tease kids from the creek for wearing Pickway specials.
We heard that. We heard that a lot. We got made fun of because we bought clothes at Kmart. Comments about our blue light specials.
But how did it make you feel?
Less than. I mean, we never really had a problem with clothes until we came to school up on the hill.
So Randy and I spent much of the afternoon driving around Loudondale, where he grew up on Davis Creek. Back when we were kids, those creeks were used as a makeshift dump. People would chuck trash into them and old tires and washing machines. But now it looks like someone has cleaned them out. When Randy dropped me off at my mom's house, I couldn't stop thinking about how some of us Hillers made him feel. I started talking about it with my mom. She certainly remembered Joey Minardi and his obsession with clothes and shoes. Mom was like a second mother to Joey, and she teared up when I asked her about him.
I mean, yes, Joe was a bully. I don't want to say that. I mean, Joey tried to fit in. The whole family was that way.
Mom remembered Mrs. Minardi telling her that she got some of Joey's clothes at Goodwill.
And he wasn't too damn proud of it. So if he got a pair of Pumas or whatever, you know, he was going to let the world know about it.
He was nicely dressed, all.
He was. I mean, she did a wonderful job. She worked at it. I mean, you know, she would go buy those things and fix and repair and hem and take in. And, I mean, you know, she did. I mean, and I applaud her for it. I'm not looking down my nose. I mean, they didn't have money. Yeah. But they presented like they did. And, I mean, you know, and they were good people. I liked all of them.
Talking with my mom made me even more curious about Joey. It had been a while since I'd seen him, but I knew that he'd moved down to Florida. So what happened to this boisterous, virile, muscle-bound, badass bully who in the same breath could charm your mother like Eddie Haskell and taunt his enemies as boldly as Muhammad Ali?
I'm Joey Minardi III, and born and raised in Charleston, West Virginia. My parents moved there in the early 70s in Fort Hill.
So you may be thinking, wait a minute, this is your burly high school classmate who left underclassmen cowering? Yeah, that's Joey, and he sounds and appears much older than his years. When I went to visit Joey and his wife at their home in Florida, I hadn't seen him in years. I did know that he spent most of his time in a wheelchair due to his illness, CIDP.
Chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, an illness I've had for 19 years now. And I was fortunate enough to get to a neurologist, immunologist in Baltimore, Dr. Carol Koski, and she gave me rounds of chemotherapy and a bunch of different things, and it was able to stifle the illness because it was rapidly getting into my respiratory system, and if it would have done that, then I wouldn't have been able to breathe, and that would have been it.
When I knew Joey, he was a beefy, robust guy. He moved from the East End, an ethnically diverse working-class part of Charleston, across the Kanawha River, and up into my neighborhood in the Fort Hill section of South Hills. Joey says it was kind of like the Jeffersons on TV, moving on up. They moved just down the street from my house in the summer before we went into sixth grade.
Honestly, I remember the fact that it was the first home my mom and dad were able to own, and that was a big thing for our family. Exciting for my mom to have her first house. You know, they were in their 40s at that time and worked real hard to get there.
Joey's mom was a homemaker, and his dad was a traveling shoe leather salesman.
I mean, he was really a hustler, and I remember when we moved on the hill, you know, it was such a big step. They went from $75 a month rent to $175 a month house payment. And I can remember that being stressful for my parents. And there were weeks that he was traveling a couple thousand miles a week sometimes, just around the state. He would leave her, I remember in the 60s, like $5 or $10 to go a whole week. And she had to buy food and gas with that. It's pretty incredible when you think about it.
What do you remember about the Hillers and the Creekers?
Well, whether or not you were from Miney or not, which we, you know, in my family, we weren't. I mean, we had to watch every dime back then. But the Creekers were even, they were in worse shape than that. And they used to really take it hard for what they thought was the rich boys that were up on the hill, that we somehow had a better life than they did.
Well, did we?
I don't know that we did. I think the thought that the Hillers may have all come from money when that wasn't the case. It, you know, that there was like a silver spoon in the Hillers' mouth, and that wasn't the case.
Some of them had a silver spoon in their mouth. I mean, some of the Hillers actually had a good bit of money.
Well, yeah, but you understand the difference because you grew up in a time where there wasn't a lot of money available to do every last thing that you wanted to do. I definitely did. My folks, they said save and scrimp a lot.
Do you remember Randy Thomas?
Oh, yes. I always liked Randy. But, you know, Randy was a Creeker. Right?
What was a Creeker?
A Creeker would have been somebody from Loudondale and Davis Creek and those areas.
I mean, how did we treat the Creekers back in the day?
Well, we used to heckle them pretty good. I don't think we realized exactly that a lot of them were coming from poverty. It always seemed like to me that the kids from the creek came dirty. Their jeans always seemed to be soiled, greasy, long hair. It seemed like they were always out back smoking. But when you're younger, I didn't like, was nasty or heckled them, but they couldn't help that they were from, you know, poverty and whatnot. I know a lot of those kids didn't have much guidance. A lot of, busted up families. A lot of them lived in shanties down through there.
Double wide?
Not even a double wide. I mean, real shanties.
It's true, the Creekers didn't have a lot of money, at least not when I was going to school. Back then, your family's means determined how you dressed. Whether or not they were cheaper, flannel shirts were what Creekers wore. I remember a time when my mother gave me a nice flannel shirt for Christmas. I recall smiling and saying thank you, knowing that I might wear this shirt around the house or maybe at family functions. But as a Hiller, I wouldn't be caught dead at school in such a shirt, for fear of looking like a Creeker. Just like my mom, Mrs. Minardi bought Joey a flannel shirt for Christmas, and his didn't get much use either.
I think that it wadded up and stayed in the trunk of the car most of the time. And it was a nice shirt, but it wasn't something that I was interested in wearing at that time because it looked like a Creeker or a country boy, and I wanted to be a little more sophisticated. And that, you know, my family had worked hard to try to get on the hill, so I was going to try to wear things that looked a little, you know, a little better than that. That's what I was interested in those days.
In kind of projecting that image.
Right. To look better than a Creeker would. Yeah. You know, even though we had friends that were Creekers, we, buddies that we drank beer with every weekend, I wasn't interested in wearing some of those clodhopper boots, and I wouldn't wear it today.
You and I were consciously trying to make sure that we were not dressing or looking like Creekers.
Definitely. And, you know, back then is when the designer jeans and stuff like that started. And, you know, we were definitely trying to wear the nicer things. I wanted to, you know, be able to make friends. I was obsessed with trying to be accepted at that new step up in life.
On the map, the Minardis were Hillers, and Joey's mom provided the stylish clothes that they wanted in order to fit in. But she was calculated and thrifty in how she did it.
One of the best stores in Charleston was Frankenburger's. And she would go and shop for clothing several months ahead of time. She'd lay it away and pay for it a few bucks at a time. We're talking about, you know, back in the 60s. And we didn't start getting things really from Kmart until maybe up into the mid to late 70s. My mom shopped at Kmart on Patrick Street a lot. You know, she learned then she could buy a whole lot more with a dollar there than downtown Charleston. So we did get a lot of things from there.
I remembered what my mom said about Mrs. Minardi going to Goodwill, and I asked Joe about it.
She very well could have. I don't recall shopping and dressing us originally from there. You know, with my attitude back then, I probably wouldn't have liked that as much.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if you'd been seen shopping at Goodwill or, you know, Salvation Army or one of those three stores, it may have been considered, you know, somebody that couldn't afford. And I'm not saying that we could afford any more than that. But I know early on, in the early days, that my mom really scrimped to be able to make her family look nice.
Now, let's be clear. There's nothing shameful about shopping at thrift stores. Unless you're an insecure teenager trying to project an image of affluence. And quite frankly, that was me. When I was in eighth grade, my parents separated. And the day my father moved out, my mom took me shopping at a thrift store. And I remember worrying to myself, with Dad gone, are we going to be poor? And if we are, what will people think? And will I still be a Hiller? So it seems kind of silly now, but in a way, these were the kind of things that occupied the minds of guys like Joey and me. When I was in Florida and sitting in Joey's living room, I played some of my interview with Randy, including the section where he talks about being heckled for his shoes and clothes from Kmart.
I'll tell you what, you don't realize when you're a kid how much damage you're doing to somebody. Who would have ever known that Randy would have had those issues and that was such an upsetting thing to him? Because he always seemed to be, you know, fun-loving, funny guy. You know, you'd probably never think that you would be friends with maybe a kid that was look like a ragamuffin, you know. But when it was all said and done, some of those boys ended up being a whole lot better friends than the boys that came from real money, you know.
As you know, shoes were paramount to Joey.
Tennis shoes were a big issue back then. We all, you remember that, my goodness. But that was an important thing for us. I remember having to save up. I had a pair of suede Adidas in red, and I had a pair of black Puma, and they were very nice shoes. But man, oh man, just something to get a satisfaction like that. I understand where Randy's coming from.
After I had that time with Randy, I went home and I talked to Mom a little bit, and I said, Mom, do you remember, like, you know, I remember, like, me and Joey, we'd talk about Pickway shoes, and then Joey moved in the neighborhood, and we were, like, all obsessed about getting Adidas and Pumas and stuff like that. And she said she remembered it, and I said, well, what do you remember about Joey at the time? She said, well, Joey, you know, he wanted to feel good about himself. And this is a direct quote. She said, if he had a pair of Pumas, he wanted the world to know about it.
That's right. She's right. That's a true statement. And I'll tell you what got me in big, big trouble with the Pumas and Adidas is I wore both of them entirely too much. day in and day out and never giving them a break. I got serious athlete's foot, and I had to go to the doctor. It gave me athlete's foot, but wearing them too much. It took months to get over that. It covered my entire foot. It was like a shingles of the foot. It was bad, a bad deal. It's just where you don't allow your shoes to dry, and you just keep wearing them. And I was going to wear those things, hell or high water. The two pair Puma and Adidas. I'll never forget. One was black suede and one was red suede.
Since we're on the subject of shoes, I couldn't drive all the way down to Florida without asking Joey about our fight back in the sixth grade.
Now, you and I scrapped. Do you remember?
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Well, yeah. I got a memory of one particular scrap. Do you know what I'm going to bring up?
Probably in front of Ms. Roman in sixth grade, yeah. I remember that well.
Well, if you remember it well, what's your side of the story?
Yeah, I can't remember why we had it. I remember we had it and how upset she was. She was scared to death. I think she felt like she was going to get hurt. But
we were two really big kids.
Yeah, we were two big kids. I mean, you know, you got to think about this. I was shaving at about 12, 13 years old. I'd already had a lot of body hair that other kids didn't have. You know, I just grew up early.
You had big muscles then.
Yeah, big muscles then.
Well, let me tell you what I remember. You said from the back of the classroom, "Will the guy with the sorry Adidas please sit down?"
Oh, gosh. Is that what I said? Yes. I can't remember that. The sorry Adidas. Probably the Adidas that I helped you pick out. I can't understand why I would have said that. I was probably jealous from some other reason. Probably because of one of the little girls there. You know, Beth was a cutie back then. Sarah was a cutie back then. You know, by the time we were sixth grade, we were really interested in those girls.
After high school, Joey started a restaurant that was wildly successful. It multiplied and expanded into catering. However, at the height of his success, he fell ill, just in his mid-30s, and was forced to abandon the businesses he'd built. After sticking it out for a few years in Charleston, he had to abandon West Virginia as well, for a warmer climate that was more suitable for his physical condition.
I mean, I used to be a healthy, pretty robust guy. I went from that working 100-hour work weeks for the first few years of this illness. I mean, I couldn't even wipe my own butt. I'd have to be pulled up in bed, kind of a prisoner in my own body at that time. I mean, you don't know how glad I am now just to be able to reach over and pick up something to drink under my own power. And I get out and do things. I work in the flowers. I mean, I'm productive. I help the neighbors. You know, we have a good, happy life here.
Joey's insecurities about status and fitting in have obviously faded. These days, he's more determined to maintain his limited mobility and to carefully follow his doctor's orders. Randy's certainly moved on, too, but it doesn't take much for him to feel the pain of a 40-year-old wound. But what we couldn't see back then was how these anxieties focused on appearances. And we were clueless that this insecurity was something that everyone was feeling. No one knew that Randy, the creaker, bought his Nikes with his own hard-earned money. Nobody knew that Joey came from a family of truly humble means who worked tirelessly to help their son look the part of a healer. And that all of this angst and bullying was just about trying to fit in. All three of us struggled to come to terms with that feeling of being less than, incomplete, or even worse, poor. On Us and Them, we often wade into some of the enormous, seemingly intractable differences that divide Americans. Abortion, gun rights, climate science, and what to do with the symbols of the Confederacy. I mean, that's big, big stuff. And it's often hard to wrap your arms around it. But we've got this idea that if we take time to listen more deeply to the other side, maybe we'll find more similarities. One strategy for approaching these bigger issues could be as simple as understanding the differences between Hillers and Creekers and those who wear Adidas, Nikes, and Pumas and those who wear Pickway Specials.
That was Trey Kay, host and producer of Us and Them, a podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Us and Them is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. And you can listen to more episodes about Appalachia's cultural divide on usandthempodcast.com. On today's show, we're kicking off the new academic year here in Appalachia with stories about the realities of life in schools here. Next, the rural community of McDowell County, West Virginia, continues to struggle to recruit public school teachers. For many in Appalachia, this story isn't anything new, but the problem is getting worse as the economy continues to decline in the coalfields. This next story comes to us from the Educate podcast from APM Reports. In the first part of this episode, we hear how many urban school districts, like in Philadelphia, struggle to attract and retain black male teachers. Rural communities also have trouble with chronic teacher turnover. We pick up APM's story where reporter Emily Hanford focuses on how the rural community of McDowell County, West Virginia, is dealing with its ongoing teacher shortage.
It's not easy to get to McDowell County. There's just one main road in and out. A winding two-lane that follows the curves of the Appalachian Mountains. People came here for the coal in those mountains, building homes on the sides of steep hills where it does not seem houses should be. Coal mining once employed about 65% of the working population here. Today, it's less than 20%. The government now employs more people than the coal companies, and the largest employer is the McDowell County Schools.
When I say Fine, what does it mean?
Stop.
We are stopped.
I visit Welch Elementary School, where Ann Turley teaches music. She divides her time among three schools, a modern-day circuit rider delivering music education the way itinerant clergy once saved souls. Today, she's teaching first graders. The kids are walking in a circle, tossing balloons to keep count with the music. There are 18 students, including a redhead wearing a tie. It's his first day. His parents just moved here from Mississippi as part of a mission group trying to help McDowell County. McDowell County is in the poorest part of West Virginia. It ranks second in the nation for prescription drug overdose deaths and has one of the lowest life expectancies of any county in the United States. Nearly half the students in McDowell County schools live with someone other than a biological parent. Ann Turley says she sometimes questions whether she's the right person for the job.
Because I feel like I need to be a counselor or a social worker or somebody with a little more crisis intervention kind of skills.
Just this morning, the father of one of her fourth graders died after being shot in what a police spokesman said was a drug-related incident. After school, I go home with Ann Turley.
Yeah, this was the first one finished, and we were the first occupants.
Ann and her husband, Brian, live in what's known as the Teacher Village. Village is a bit of a stretch. It's a couple of abandoned homes that a local nonprofit has fixed up and turned into apartments specifically for teachers. Brian's on the phone when we walk in.
Well, that is a great blessing. I appreciate it.
Ann and Brian moved to McDowell County 6 months ago. They're both from West Virginia. Ann's from right here in McDowell. They'd lived other places for years, but with their son grown and their elderly mothers in need of help, they decided it was time to move back home.
750 square feet, as I have reckoned it, and...
Brian's giving me a tour of their apartment. In urban areas, affordable housing can be a big issue for teachers. In rural areas, it's housing, period. There aren't many rentals. What's available is often run down. Another issue in rural areas, a job for your spouse. Brian had been a college professor and a minister. He has a PhD. When they decided to move back to West Virginia, they both started applying for jobs.
He probably had about five times as many applications out there as me because I don't have a lot of experience at anything.
But she got the first offer. She'd done some teaching and had her teacher certification.
They were so desperate here. I was taken sight unseen.
Didn't even have to do an interview. Brian, on the other hand, couldn't find a job.
Oh, this car's really a mess. I'm so sorry.
I wanted to get a better idea of what's in McDowell County, so I got a driving tour from Kathy Jack.
I've been here my whole life. My brother and sister moved away, but I stayed.
Kathy Jack has been a teacher here for 35 years.
My grandparents came here from the Eastern Panhandle in 1924 to get teaching jobs. And they lived in that house the whole time they were married, raised my mother and her two brothers.
So your family came here for education, not for coal?
Yes, actually they did.
The U.S. Census puts McDowell County's population at its peak in 1950, when nearly 100,000 people lived here. When Kathy Jack was growing up, the city of Welch, the McDowell County seat, was known around here as Little New York.
On Saturdays, I mean, the streets were full of people, and we had women's stores, men's stores, shoe stores, toy stores. I mean, you didn't have to go outside of Welch to buy anything. We have so many stores downtown Welch.
Today, there are fewer than 20,000 people left in McDowell County.
We're going through downtown Welch. I'm going to pull through here.
There's a mortuary, a social security office, a barber shop, but mostly the buildings are empty.
There used to be a dry cleaner's right there.
There's a time-stood-still quality to this place, kind of like neighborhoods I visited in Philadelphia. But this place is so much more isolated geographically. To get to a major store from Welch, you have to drive more than 30 miles. It could take an hour on the winding two-lane, more if you get stuck behind a coal truck. Convincing people who aren't from here to move here is a tall order. But there aren't enough qualified people in McDowell County to staff the schools. Just 5% of people here have bachelor's degrees. So the schools have to go out and recruit.
We are at Concord University for a career fair in the hopes to recruit some teachers.
Tanya White is the personnel director for McDowell County Schools.
Thinking about teaching?
Concord University is in a neighboring county.
Possibly subbing.
Tanya's here with her administrative assistant, a can of Mountain Dew, and a stack of job applications.
If the past is any indication of what today is going to be, it's going to be many different school systems kind of fighting for the same kids.
By kids, she means the soon-to-be college graduates wandering among the recruiters' tables. A recruiter from a neighboring district comes over and hands Tanya and her assistant a book of resumes from another job fair. McDowell couldn't afford the fees for that one. They start flipping through the resumes. Plenty of people who want to teach elementary school, slim pickings on high school math.
Hi. How are you all?
Good, how are you?
A couple of soon-to-be graduates stop by, Devin Graham and Amber Shrewsbury.
So you guys going into teaching?
Yes, elementary ed.
Okay, great. Thinking about McDowell, maybe?
Well, I'm a little higher. I'm Raleigh, borderline Fayette.
No, they're not really thinking about McDowell. Here's what they say when I pull them aside.
More as of a last resort kind of thing, I guess. But as of right now, I would drive pretty much anywhere as long as I had a job.
We're going by that beggars can't be choosers rule as of right now. When you're fresh out of college, you really can't be picky.
They say they might take a job in McDowell for a year or two, but their dream is to teach in the district where they grew up. That's not a surprise. More than 60% of new teachers teach within 15 miles of their hometown. More than a third take their first job in the district where they went to high school. The implications of this are sobering for a place like McDowell County, where only about 40% of high school graduates go on to college, and most college graduates don't come back. But this high school junior, Sierra, says she will come back.
I plan on being a biology teacher, coming back to McDowell, and I just want to make it different than what it is.
She's bitter about the fact that so many teachers come and go.
When I come back, I want to fix it. I want to make it where that student's going to learn what they need to learn and that student's going to learn what he needs to learn. And I'm not going to just ditch my students.
This year, her math teacher quit abruptly after Christmas, and a sub with no training in math education filled in. She had lots of subs in 9th and 10th grade math, too.
I don't know any math. You can hand me like a freshman year math, and I'm like, no, I don't know. I'm sorry.
She's worried about whether she'll be ready for college.
When I get in college, I got to take college math. But how am I supposed to do that if I don't know back to basics?
Her classmate Bryce says he feels bad for teachers who get stuck teaching a subject they don't know. They try their best, he says, but
sometimes your best is not enough.
Bryce thinks more teachers would come and stay if they were paid better. But Sierra says it shouldn't be about money.
You gotta help McDowell. I mean, it's not just all about the money. I mean, I don't wanna be a teacher for the money. I wanna be a teacher because someone's gotta redo the education system.
Because you really wanna do it. But then you get a lot of people, they wanna do it, but there's not enough money, so they go into something else.
Bryce and Sierra get into a bit of a spat. She says people who grow up in McDowell and go to college have an obligation to come back. He says he'd love to be able to do that, but
as it is now, I don't think I could for what I want to be.
He wants to be an accountant.
I love it here, but it's just, I have to build a foundation for my family. And right now, there's not much to build on.
This is the dilemma for so many people. They want to stay, but they just can't. I asked teachers what they would do if they didn't have teaching, and they say things like McDonald's, the Rite Aid. There is a hospital, the county government. One woman was a deputy sheriff before becoming a teacher. And there are the prisons, three of them. A federal prison opened in 2010, promising 300 jobs. But fewer than one in five employees is a McDowell County resident. Part of the problem is that many people wouldn't be able to pass the drug test.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good.
Hi.
It's been a few months since I've seen Ann and Brian Turley, so I stopped by their apartment. Ann's the music teacher. Brian was looking for a job, and he's found one at the Stevens Correctional Center. He's the prison librarian.
Some days I go in and somebody is asking me for the latest Gary Larson.
That's the Far Side cartoon guy.
And a few minutes later, someone will come in and ask me for Plutarch or, you know, some Hellenistic classic work.
He likes it.
I'm sometimes in a room by myself with 24 felons, and I come home saying, you know, it's great. The inmates are just great. They're very respectful. They like what I'm doing. And Ann has had the really tough day.
With fifth graders.
She had a particularly bad day with her fifth graders on Monday.
Just the level of disrespect and some children, I don't know that I could ever interest them in what I'm doing, but yet they are intent on being, I don't know how to describe them, some of them. Attention starved, and they'll get attention however they can get it.
Some days she thinks about quitting.
Days like Monday, if I had days like that every day, I would have already left.
But she and Brian like living here. They've made friends, they hike, they're thinking about buying a house. Anne is a bit worried, though, that she might not have a job next year. This is something teachers here worry about, because even though this county is desperate for teachers, every year some of them get laid off.
It's hard to explain to someone who hasn't been in it because it don't make sense.
This is Tanya White again, the personnel director.
The State Department makes, they do a formula, and it determines how many positions that they will fund for you to have. And it's based on your student enrollment.
And every year, McDowell County loses students. This year, the West Virginia Department of Education told McDowell it was over formula by 15 teaching positions. So in March, Tanya White drove to the schools where positions were being cut and met with each teacher getting laid off.
That was a scary day.
That's Hubert Mullins, and this is his wife, Jessica Mullins.
They called me in first.
Jessica and Hubert Mullins are special education teachers at the same elementary school in McDowell County.
And as soon as I was finished, they called him over the intercom to report to the office. So I thought to myself, yes. Yes, we are both losing our jobs today.
That music you hear in the background, it's the song that comes on over the school intercom every day at dismissal. To hear more about the Mullins' story, I visit them at home in the evening. That's me walking up the steps to their front door. 43 steps, one of those houses built into the side of a steep hill. That's their cat, Oliver. They have several cats, all named after Dickens characters.
Good. Ooh, wow, I'm envious. What a great house.
Their house is beautiful. Built-in cabinets with leaded glass doors, a huge fireplace, four bedrooms, 2.5 baths. They bought it for $15,000.
I think right before us it was a drug house.
because when we first moved in, all hours of the night, people would knock on our door. And we'd always say, you know, it's closed. This is new management.
Hubert and Jessica are both from McDowell County. They met working at Walmart.
I was reading one of his favorite books in the break room.
It was a novel called The Lovely Bones. The Walmart where they worked was in McDowell County, but it shut down in 2016, taking 140 jobs and tens of thousands of dollars in tax revenue with it. When Walmart closed, Jessica had already convinced Hubert to go to college with her. Their fathers had been coal miners. They were going to be teachers.
We always said, you know, that they always need teachers, but the population is just leaving in droves, and where they might have needed five teachers before, they'll need one.
Whoops. Oh, wiggle worm.
That's their three-year-old, Liam. The Mullins' teacher training was interrupted when they had him, and they're still working on their teacher certifications. That's why they got laid off. They're at the bottom of the seniority list, and West Virginia has strict rules that teachers with the least seniority must be laid off first. Now the Mullinses are thinking about the possibility of leaving McDowell County.
Right now it's scary because we know this area and this is all we've ever known.
We're small town, rural people, we really are. And it would be a huge adjustment for us to just move somewhere where we didn't know everybody. Okay.
It's a reality now. We never thought that it would be.
They're hoping maybe Hubert will get his job back. Jessica's position was eliminated. His still exists. It just had to be offered to another teacher with more seniority. They've heard that teacher is looking for a job somewhere else. The teacher problem in McDowell County is complex. The chaos and uncertainty caused by annual layoffs don't help. But Superintendent Nelson Spencer says there's not much he can do about it. It all goes back to what's going on with the local economy. What would really help, he says, is a road, a modern four-lane highway in and out of the county.
It would open us up, really, basically, is what it would do. And it would bring in a better economy. We would have more people to stay, more people want to stay. You would have developers in.
People have been talking about the need for this highway for a long time.
It has been since I was a young man, and now I'm not near a young man anymore.
There's renewed hope that something will happen. A new governor who's talking about the highway, and President Trump and his promises on infrastructure. Nelson Spencer says even if a new highway didn't lead to much economic development, at least it would make it easier for teachers to commute here. Close to a third of McDowell teachers don't live in McDowell County. But ultimately, it's the teachers who live here and grew up here, people with roots in this community, who are the most likely to stay for the long haul. That's why Personnel Director Tanya White has started a Grow Your Own program. The hope is to sell students in McDowell County on the idea of becoming teachers and coming back home.
If I can't recruit them, I'm hoping to raise them.
This year, she started a McDowell County chapter of Educators Rising, a national organization that tries to get high school students on the path to teaching careers. An interesting note, the fellowship in Philadelphia has started a local chapter of Educators Rising, too. Since so many teachers prefer to work close to where they grew up, Grow Your Own is kind of an obvious and necessary solution for schools that can't find and keep the teachers they need. In Philadelphia and other urban school districts, the question is whether teachers will choose to stay, given the working conditions in many of the schools. Here in McDowell County, the question is, will there be any children left to teach in another generation or two? Just a few last notes about the story in McDowell County. Hubert Mullins got his job back. The teacher who was offered his position did indeed take a job in another county. So the Mullinses are staying in McDowell, at least for now. Ann Turley, the music teacher, she did not get laid off. And despite her struggles with that fifth grade class, she's coming back for another year of teaching. She and her husband, Brian, just bought a house.
That was Emily Hanford with APM Reports. Emily's full documentary called Keeping Teachers can be heard on the Educate podcast from American Public Media. It's a podcast about education, opportunity, and how people learn. Thanks to the producers at American Public Media for sharing that story from McDowell County with us. On our website, we've posted a link where you can hear more from this episode and learn how to subscribe to the Educate podcast. That's at wvpublic.org. My mother insisted that her kids wore nice, name-brand clothing. I never worried about someone making fun of my clothes because she worked at a department store and would frequently come home with the latest styles. She always watched the sales closely. Now, don't get me wrong, middle school classmates found other ways to exclude me, but clothing was never one of them. No, we weren't rich, but I kind of dressed like I was. It made me feel confident and worthy of pursuing my dreams. My mom drove an hour each way, almost every day to work. Yeah, so she could make a little money. But perhaps more than that, it was a way to protect us from the perception of being poor and being ridiculed for it, like she was. I never, ever felt poor. We lived in a home built in the turn of the century with holes in the floor and in the walls with limited heat. But I never felt poor. And for those who didn't visit my house, they never knew any different. And eventually, she even found a way to move us into a brand new home. But maybe that story is for another show. Kids are mean, but so are adults. I've grown comfortable in finding good deals on nice clothes still as an adult. But finding value in these items might make me seem shallow or materialistic. But the way others pass judgment on me, I'm learning, is not my problem. That's our show. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Us and Them podcast and American Public Media. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd and I worked together to produce the show. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.